Welcome to Heritage Radio Network on Tour, broadcasting live from Feast, Portland. I'm Dana Cowan, and before we kick things off, I want to thank Travel Portland, Stream PDX, and the Julia Child Foundation for making our coverage of Feast possible. Right now, I'm joined by two extraordinary women who have so much in common, but they've never met. So I'm very excited to like be here on your sort of, you know, first date, if you will. Emma Bengston is the executive chef at Aquavit in New York City, and Kristen Murray is the chef owner of Maurice. And I am lucky in that though you guys don't know each other, I know your food. And I had the pleasure. I'm doing Radio Verite, I decided. So anytime I'm talking to someone, I want to have actually had their food, which was great because I started my day, Kristen, with your food at Maurice. And it put me on a sugar high all day. I started with angel food cake with some poppy seeds, a lemon cloud.
Lemon souffle pudding cake, yeah.
Yeah, lemon souffle pudding cake. Amazing. So... Now, the two of you live on different coasts, but one of the things that you have in common is that you cook Scandinavian. You're influenced by Scandinavia to one degree or another. And I'm curious, you both worked at Aquavit, right? So, but did you overlap at Aquavit?
No, many moons apart. Yeah, almost a decade.
I think around that.
Yeah.
Oh, this is going to be easy, because you can tell that one person has an accent and the other doesn't. So the first person who answered was Kristen,
yeah,
and the second person who answered was Emma. So let's just talk about where your inspiration for cooking came from. It's one of your commonalities, because you both had extraordinary grandmothers, from what I can tell. So Emma, do you want to talk about growing up in a fishing village in Sweden and the cooking culture that you grew up with?
Sure. I grew up on the west coast of Sweden, and my grandmother lived in the south. Both my mom and my grandmother were amazing home cooks, and getting the opportunity to have the ingredients and the seafood and everything the land has to offer so close, I think I grew up very spoiled, like not really knowing about it, getting everything fresh, everything from the market, everything. Nothing was half produced or bought in a can. So without even knowing it, I think that influenced me in the way I cook today and the way I don't want to ruin the ingredients in a way. I always want to highlight what it is and take the best out of it instead of turning it into something that might be extraordinary in certain restaurants, but it's not my culinary philosophy to see on food. I want to see what it is, I want to know what it is, and taste what it actually is.
And Kristen, I think, is going to concur 100%.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's true. I mean, kind of, for me, it was being raised by my grandmother and my great aunt, but in California, everything was so fresh, and I was sort of the odd kid that had the avocado Munster butter lettuce sandwich with homemade persimmon walnut cookies. Yeah, I didn't realize how unique and special that was. And my style of cooking is very similar to exactly what you said. It could be defined by your exact words. It's fresh, it's reflective of the ingredient, it's celebrating kind of trying to layer that versus masking it with too much butter, although I'm sorry I made you sugar high.
You know, well, it's only because I ate. I mean, to be fair, had
you
I
had
eaten.
Three.
Well, I had
two.
Five. Oh. So, to be fair, had I only had one breakfast, that would have been great. But I took the sampling approach and got sort of one of everything.
Which is great.
And that is what affected me so tremendously. So, don't feel it was that your food had too much sugar in it.
But it's usually really I balanced. Joke and say that it's like spa food to save room for dessert at the shop.
Do you have moments in your memories of being taught something specific, like that memory where you're like, oh, this is what it is. This is what cooking is. This is what being intimate with food or my grandmother or anything like that.
Lefse. When I was six, my great-grandma Nora taught me how to make it. And just the... it's so simple, but the warm, flat potato, potato-esque crepe flatbread with just a little bit of butter and sugar rolled is it. Every time I make it, it brings me back to being a little girl in the kitchen. And it's so simple and so good and so satisfying. And seeing Scandinavians come in and see us making it or have it on the menu, they get kind of schmelty and excited. I don't serve it the way I was first given it because I couldn't keep up with making that many. So I end up using it more like an open face wrap for the Norwegian meatballs or gravlax. But yeah, I would say lefse is kind of the thing I always come back to, and it's very special.
I never really got the opportunity to cook alongside my grandmother that much, but she did always send me her recipes, and I kind of had to figure out a trial and error myself at the kitchen at home.
That's interesting. So were you trying to channel her because you knew it was what it should taste like?
Yes. I mean, she always cooked it when we came to visit, and I was always allowed in the kitchen with her, but she was always super organized and ahead of time with everything. So I think in a way I might have been a little bit more in the way than helping. So it was kind of a thing I would taste it and I would look and I would see what she was doing, and then when I returned back home I would go crazy myself in the kitchen making a mess and figuring out like how to perfect different things, much to despair of my parents cleaning up after me. But so it was more about that situation for me.
It's good that they cleaned up after you, because some people would be like, yeah, sorry. Another thing that you have in common is that you both started in pastry and have gone to savory, or do both. I mean, not gone to, but incorporated both, which I think is such an interesting journey because it's the reverse of so many things. How did that happen? How were you attracted to pastry first? I know you both have tremendous, great restaurant experience doing pastry. And then how did it happen that you moved over and did both?
So I went to school for all of things, culinary, front of the house, back of the house, everything was included. And I actually wanted to be a savory cook coming out of school. But unfortunately and fortunately, I ended up with my first internship. The pastry chef needed help. So I stayed with him for 3 months, and then he turned out to be leaving the restaurant. So I stuck around, and that turned into 5 years.
Wow.
So I actually had the intention of being savory, but then I went into pastry and I turned to love that profession. And that's a different way of thinking, and you can tell between pastry and savory cooks, the difference is very, very big.
How can you tell?
Organization, most of the times. And you want to keep your things neat, you work clean. Not saying that savory doesn't, but there's just when it's different. When you're in the field, you can definitely see who's been pastry trained and who hasn't. There's definitely something that stands out between it, and it just fit me really well.
Why did it take you? Well, were you happy spending 5 years doing pastry, or did you feel during that time you had sort of been derailed from your, direction?
I never thought about it. No. And it just, everything fits so perfectly. And back home in Sweden as well, when you do pastry, you're also in charge of the starters. So I would still be able to do, it was a different kind of technique. So I think that's why pastry and starters are a little bit combined, because the technique we were using in pastry, we were also using in our first courses. So I did that. And then after that, I moved on to only doing pastry for another 10 years. And that's when I lost my savory a little bit. So it, and I was happy with it.
And you also started pastry. You're doing a ton of pastry now, but doing both.
Yeah, but it's interesting, again, kind of mirroring, which is eerie. So I went to school. I studied all the things. I actually didn't want to be a girl in a bakery. If I was going to do anything pastry, I wanted to be learning bread. But I was doing an internship at a Le Rondelli restaurant in San Francisco, and again, much like you're saying, I would help with garde manger and the pastry chef, and the pastry chef ended up leaving one night in the middle of service. It was very dramatic.
Oh my goodness.
And
what had happened?
Oh, she and the chef got in a fight, which happens. And he threw me the key at the end of the night, and I had made brioche with her before everything hit the fan, and I had to come back at 3 a.m. to retard the dough. And it was a huge and amazing trial by fire experience. But that was my first pastry cook / pastry chef job, and working for a Le Rondelli really kind of made a lot of things concrete. His restaurant's no longer around, but it was the best for changing things. And I'll never forget when I made the transition from cooking to pastry, and the brulees were in the oven, the chocolate was seeding and kind of sitting and waiting, and the brioche was rising. It felt like this beautiful orchestra where all of a sudden it wasn't being a cowboy and having my guns loaded waiting for everyone to sit, and it made sense with my personality. I could plan and organize and look forward to things, and I stuck with it and still stick with it. But the way I approach my cooking is reflective and thoughtful how I do the pastry as far as temperature, texture, timing.
So you, when you opened your own restaurant, mm-hmm. Maurice, that's when you united the two sides. Like, yeah. You brought back the past, which was the savory that you had been doing, but also doing extraordinary pastry as well. So why? Because you could have just opened a pastry shop. You're known for that. I mean, yeah. The whole city of Portland knows you for that. but they obviously were happy to try something new. But why did you open a full-on restaurant?
I had been dreaming about Maurice for 12 years. Okay. And it just became more and more focused over the years. And originally I was going to open it back east because that's where I was for a very long time, New York and then Boston. And I fell in love with Maine, and so Maine seemed like maybe that's where I should do it. But it was moving toward New England, and I helped family out and was on the West Coast again, and I got a job offer to come to Portland. And after being here and meeting the farmers and meeting the community, and it's easier living here, I would say, and it's closer to family. Mm-hmm. Portland made sense to open Maurice in, and I didn't really overthink it because it had been so focused in my mind for over a decade. And I was overqualified as a pastry chef at that time, but I really wanted to stay in Portland. So it was kind of a dare against Portland to open Maurice.
Wow.
And if it didn't swim, then I would leave and go back to where I was having a healthy career and life and had another community. And it's been so sweet to see it be embraced because it's quirky and it doesn't really make sense, but it works.
I love that it was a dare.
Yeah.
How do you think about that? Like, it was just the dare was, will you accept me?
Yeah, because I loved Portland and I still love it clearly, but I was mad at it because I had worked really hard on my career and it just wouldn't take all my experience until I had to create my own space in it.
I read a 2011 interview with you, and you described Maurice. Like, it was amazing. because it was so clear, and it was recorded, you know?
How I mean, funny.
You could go back and read it. It's exactly what you've ended up doing, but in 2011.
Interesting.
So when you say that, it had been around even longer because you...
It just kept getting more focused over the years. And so my friends were really funny after it opened. They're like, oh, good. Now what else can we hear about? What next?
And for you, I the story of being offered the executive chef job, you're like, I don't think so. Why was your initial reaction to say, no, I'm not, I don't really want that job? Or is that misreported and it didn't quite happen that way?
No, it did. And I think most of it was because I worked so hard as a pastry chef, and I put in so many hours and so much thought, and I finally got my pastry department to be exactly where I wanted it to be. And mm-hmm. It was like the first time I could actually take a breath and go like, maybe I can take this Saturday off. And I would just be like, I can do this. Like, everything just was on point. And then I was like, oh, man, I'm going to go back to this again. Yeah, I have no idea what I'm doing. But, it started as a trial. I started figuring things out with the help of my chefs or my cooks, who were some of them still with me today. And little by little, day by day, everything worked itself out. And
it doesn't sound like it was resolved before the chef left, the executive chef.
No, so I came on board after he left.
But you had already been doing pastry there, no?
Yes, I was the pastry chef for 4 years.
Right, that's what I thought. Yeah, it's very interesting. And the restaurant had gotten a Michelin star.
Yes, we got one a year after I came, so 2011, if I remember correctly.
2011 is a very important, it's an important year. And I think 2014, weirdly, for both of you, is also an important year, because you opened at the very end of 2013, December, so I'm calling it 2014, and your executive, I was going to say editor, oh boy, executive chef role was 2014. So you both had these cataclysmic changes in 2014, which I just thought was, as I was doing your biography, something like, that's so interesting. Mm-hmm. And now you've both had about 4 years of, you know, following, I don't know if it's your dream. In your case, Kristen, I feel like it's your dream. And part of everything that I had read about the restaurant in advance was what was really a fantasy. Mm-hmm. And I went in and I was like, it doesn't feel completely fantastical. I mean, except for like there's little rabbits' heads at the, edge of the seats, and there's a beautiful string of, what's on those little strings at the top of your ceiling?
Oh, I got this kooky idea to do these really lovely garlands seasonally. And so they have cotton always, because cotton is arduous to pick, like pastry is to make.
They're metaphorical garlands.
Of course they are. Rose hips for Scandinavia, bay leaves for California. And then whatever else is in season and will dry nicely.
And do you make those yourself?
Actually, Hilary Horvath, my florist, and I do them together. So she actually drills holes in each of those things and strings them, and then I hang them and space them out. And so it's, Remodelista did a really nice piece on them, but it's been interesting trying to wrestle with them and being in sort of a glass fishbowl at times and having people come up to the glass and watch you when you're just cursing at these things. I'm like, no, look away, please. keep going. So,
but yeah, it's a bit
they're great. They're sweet and they are whimsical.
Whimsical. And there's a little bit of a fantasy. Were you intending a fantasy?
Again, I just kind of do things and I don't overthink them, and then it happens and I'm happy I did it. So
like Maurice, the notion that you have a restaurant named after a pet stuffed rabbit, live rabbit
yeah Maurice was a French lop that I named after Maurice Chevalier, and so I'm no offense to strange cat ladies, but I never wanted to be a strange bunny lady. But I know I now have a restaurant named after my pet. But the reason being is because he was a really great mascot. He was with me for 12 years. I treated him like a dog child companion and took him on the subway in New York and to Central Park and camping with me. I just didn't think about him as a bunny. And so when I was thinking about the business, I wanted it to be like my mascot that would be positive and be around. And Maurice kept coming to my head, and he's not around anymore, but the memory and the feeling that he gave is, and that's what I want my business to give people, so it's named after him.
How did you choose a bunny?
I didn't. I was engaged in a past life in New York, and he was not into cats, and he thought a rabbit would be a good fix, so the rabbit stayed and he didn't.
And does, when you took the rabbit about, did he have a rabbit cage?
No, I put him in a vintage picnic basket and would invert it over him to protect him in Central Park. And
did he have a leash?
He had a leash, yes. Not did, when we would go camping.
Did you get a lot of stares?
There was a lot of conversation. Mm. Yeah, people were always very curious. And he was a big bunny.
He was a big bunny.
He was about 9 pounds. So, yeah.
I feel bad now that I thought it was stuffed, but
oh,
on the other
okay.
hand...
Oh, that's okay. No, yeah. I mean, it's...
Yeah, we grew up... I grew up in Manhattan in an apartment, and we had a rabbit, a turtle, and a chicken.
Chicken.
Wow.
Yes, in a New York apartment. I still can't believe that the chicken thing is true. But apparently, and the chicken, like, landed on... My father was bald, and the chicken landed on my father's bald head and, like, sat there, and that was the end of the chicken. So we took the chicken. I mean... It didn't die or anything. We didn't wring its neck, but we brought it to the zoo. And I don't really know what happened when it got to the zoo. I just know that that was the end of us having a chicken.
Right.
At home.
Yeah. Well, Maurice was actually my second rabbit. My first rabbit was when I was a child, and I didn't remember this memory for a long time until family and I were talking about it, but his name was Harvey after the Jimmy Stewart movie, and he was quite affectionate with our cat, and that didn't really go over well, and so one day my grandfather took Harvey to a mating farm, and I still don't know what that means, nor where Harvey went to.
See, my chicken and your first rabbit are together
somewhere.
Yes. Yes. We were talking about fantasy. So he was real, actually. He yes. wasn't a fantasy.
No.
And but you were trying to create...
It was more the feeling
the
that,
feeling.
Yeah, the that feeling I wanted the restaurant to provide to customers. And it feels good when people come in because they leave happy. It seems like a peaceful space that doesn't feel like a restaurant, unless it's very busy lunch hour, then of course it does. But it was confusing when I opened because people were looking for cupcakes and chocolate chip cookies, and why are the walls white, and when are you going to finish and put artwork up? I mean, there was lots of funny conversation, and it was just, would you like a pot of tea? Would you like a butter cookie?
You have a couple of confusing things.
Very, yeah.
Right, so you use the word fika, mm-hmm. which means coffee break, mm-hmm. but you really have great teas.
Yes.
Yes. And fika is a Swedish word, but really your heritage is Norwegian.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And so I'm just wondering.
I don't make it easy.
Uh-huh. Why is that?
I don't know. That would be like the golden ticket question. Answer, really, not question. Yeah. I don't know.
No
because
thoughts.
It's... challenge makes you grow and think, and I don't know, just I feel like there are lots of restaurants that are sort of stamps and brands of the same thing. You have your meats, your chicken, your burger, you have the predictable characters, and I don't think there's anything wrong with maybe creating something that's a little more curious and interesting, just because it doesn't make sense. Maybe it doesn't have to make sense.
I think it's lovely to have something in this world that doesn't make sense. I mean, when you as you say, I think about things that are branded and branding, and it's such a profession, you know, and there's such a route to take, and you consider this and you consider that, and everything has to align, and it's clever and it's funny, and
right.
you know, it also sticks you in a very specific moment in time. You're not stuck in a moment in time, and you're not really either stuck in a moment in time, which is an incredible thing about Aquavit. So you went there in 2014, and I wonder what type of pressure you felt to maintain and then grow that Michelin star from 1 to 2. Was that on your mind, or...?
From the beginning, the only thing on my mind and everyone's mind was to keep the one star that we got a couple of years ago. So during that summer, that was everything. I think I came on board around Easter period, and those couple of months in the summer and leading up to fall was purely focused on changing the menu as fast as possible without making too big of a difference, because Aquavit is also one of those restaurants we have a lot of returning customers, mm-hmm. a lot of people who expect a certain thing, and you can't just turn a restaurant like that upside down overnight, so it has to be very gradually moving dishes out and moving dishes in that would fit more my style of cooking. So it was a hard couple of months, and I know everyone was super nervous when we were waiting for the call, so moving up to 2 stars from there was it was not anything that we expected to hear. So,
and what do you think was the difference between the, because you were present for both, I mean you created one and you were, you know, doing pastry, doing the other, what is the difference in your mind between the 1 star you had and the 2 star that you were able to achieve?
It's so hard to say. You never really know exactly what.
But inside yourself.
Inside,
I mean,
myself?
I don't really care about the Michelin Guide too much, but, you know, like inside yourself, do you feel like there's something that you did that pushed the food, the, I mean, some part of it forward in a way?
I don't know. I think part of it was just me taking what I knew from pastry and turning that into savory versions.
And what's an example of that?
So I use a lot of like the techniques like the setting gilets and panna cottas and bavarois and ice creams and things like that in my savory kitchen nowadays, and which is always super fun to see the cooks trying to like spread certain things, which is a nightmare sometimes, but they get a hang of it. But so it's fun to start mixing those two worlds, and at the same time I also started mixing the things I started picking up in the savory, I started to move back into pastry, and I still didn't give up my pastry chef position for the almost 3 years.
Wow. I did not realize that.
So I still managed both departments for a very long time, so it was fun to overlap everything, and also I move my cooks around anytime they want, they go into pastry and they stay there for a while and then they can come back in again, so you get that all-round feeling that everything has to be connected, because there's so many restaurants I feel out there that focus either so much on their first and second courses and then desserts is just half an afterthought, mm-hmm. or they have the most brilliant pastry chef but the kitchen is not really following along. So being able to create overall in general a whole menu that actually makes sense, because you're overlooking every aspect of it, you can see it in a different way. So I think that, and like just constantly pushing for new things and new ideas, I think that's what was the difference.
So when you listen to Kristen describe, you know, she had this idea in her head for 10 years and she, you know, willed it into being, and it was a dare. And you are cooking extraordinary food in someone else's restaurant. That is yours, of course, because it's your food and people identify. You're sort of one and the same identified that way. But it's someone else's shell. Do you listen to that story and say, oh my gosh, there's something that I've been harboring and it's inspiring to me? Or are you doing exactly the food you would want to do? So you're doing it in this setting that is Aquavit, but you would pretty much, like, you're doing your dream food.
That's a little bit of a yes and a no to that question. I think everyone has a dream that they want to fulfill, but there are a path along the way that I feel like I have to follow, and I'm still learning, I'm still growing. So be able to have a power restaurant like Aquavit standing behind me and pushing me in the right direction and giving me the courage to go along the way, I find that as challenging enough, and I do get every benefit I can. No one really tells me what to do and what, right. I can't do, so I do have free range to create the cuisine and the food that I want. So
I think that the difference that I would hear is the difference of creating your setting, right? Because Kristen has created her setting, which is very personal and very, very special, and very much part of the experience. And your food is very personal. It's coming from your family. Those recipes are translated through all of your tremendous experience and then end up on the plate. But you're not controlling, I mean, you probably control service, you know, the style of service, but there's still elements that, you know, you don't get to control. And I feel like the way that the restaurant world is moving forward is, you know, towards a more personal, partly. I mean, it's bifurcated, the personal and the not.
But sometimes I feel, thank God I'm not, because to be that person who are in charge of a whole restaurant, you have to think about everything. And then also be able to actually be in the kitchen, which I know you managed to do.
But it's tough. I mean, because
it's really tough.
All of those fun, you know, cottony, powdery things, it's still a business. It still has to exist, pay the bills, pay the staff, have the extra in case the fridge goes out or there's a riot downtown and I need to pay everyone because they can't come in. Or I mean, there's weird stuff that happens that I miss the security sometimes of working for someone that is so supportive, that is your cheerleader, and you get to go in and be a rock star, mm-hmm. and know that if you show up and you push, you have that security, which sometimes isn't always the security that you think it is. I mean, they both have good and bad.
Yeah, so it's a little bit of both.
And so if you were going to, I just want to do like a mental swap for a moment. Because your backgrounds are so similar, like if you were going to come to Portland, can you even imagine what you would do with food here?
We're talking about moving here and opening here, yeah. or something?
This is a fun little game.
Wow. I would probably situate myself outside of the city, build something up with a connection to all the amazing farms that are around here, and create a little bit of a luxury away from home, where you can turn up and eat incredible food and breathe fresh air and get all the grace from that, and then return to the city after you got a little bit of peace and quiet.
Have you been to Magnus Nilsson's restaurant?
No, I haven't.
That's quite far. I mean, that's not a short trip. Mm-hmm. And in Sweden, for those of you who don't know. And what about you? Go back to New York. What would you do in New York?
Gosh. Have a little sweet railroad hole in the wall that served quiche, cheesecake, and then on the back end, oysters and muscadet at night.
Okay, come. So both of them seem like we should actually make
just
these
those four
happen.
Things. And good tea.
And good tea. Yeah. And because you've never met, I want each of you to ask the other a question, and I'm just going to be quiet. What do you want to know about each other?
Wow.
A lot, but I mean,
just ask one thing.
That's a big, big question.
I have one. What is your favorite fish that is in the States but is similar to what you grew up with? And how do you cook it?
Oh, that's easy.
Oh, dang it.
My favorite fish has always been salmon. Okay. Growing up in Falkenberg, which it's actually our stream that goes through it as a salmon fishing. So I grew up fishing salmon as a kid. And the best way that I love to cook it is my mom always used to wrap it in foil and put herbs and lemon, salt, and pepper, close it up, and then put it in the charcoal and the grill and leave it there for a little while till it was ready. So that's definitely one of my favorite things to cook and eat, nice. Of course. Wow. So I think what I'm most curious about is a little bit about your time dating back to Aquavit, mm-hmm. back in the days. And there's actually like thousands of questions when it comes to that, but I wanted to know what your favorite thing about working at Aquavit was. What made you stay there for such a long period?
Marcus. He had such lovely energy.
So Kristen worked with Marcus Samuelson.
Yeah.
When he was at Aquavit.
Yeah. And it was so challenging. It was, I met Marcus because I was working at Gramercy Tavern, and
with Claudia Fleming, who made my wedding cakes, yeah. just to say.
Oh, amazing. Yeah. But Claudia, as you probably know, would go and have time in the summer with Pierre Hermé and do little intensives. And so I was helping to cover and do Share Our Strength dinner, and that's where I met Marcus, and he liked how I worked and asked if I would come and talk with him at Aquavit. And he just... And he had this really lovely way about him where there was energy, there was excitement. He was the best cheerleader. He would push me. It's where I created a lot of recipes. I mean, my black pepper cheesecake I created there. And
you've taken it everywhere with
everywhere.
You.
Everywhere. And it's I can't like not. Every it's always...
It's like a suitcase.
Well, are you it's true. It's true. That's my luggage. But yeah. It's a good luggage to have.
Yeah.
But that recipe started with us trying to figure it out for some crazy trout taco that herring taco that he wanted. And he was always...
Oh, he still makes a herring taco.
He was always playing with sweet and savory. And so that was kind of a fun thing to explore with him. And he was hilarious. If I would make something I was really proud of, I'd turn my back on the plating because I'm sure it was very different when you were there. But... There was a rotating staff that would come in from Sweden that was my staff. So I really didn't have a solid pastry staff.
Oh,
so it was incredibly intense training, and pastry was the first place where they would go in the kitchen. Mm. And then they would move on. And so you always felt like you were going up that hill, giving all the tools, and then, okay, let's learn how to go up the hill, give you all the tools. And but it was a great challenge, and it was great fun. But there was another flavor combination that he gave me in that time, and it was a chocolate cake that I had made with an espresso sabayon and I think a pomegranate sorbet and some sort of jelly, and or maybe it didn't have the espresso, but it had the pomegranate and cardamom or something. And all of a sudden he added espresso into the sauce and started mixing it, and then was putting it on the plate and was like, here, taste this. And it was such a beautiful combination. And so that sort of marriage and partnership with him as a chef was great. And it's hard when you are a pastry cook and you give so much energy and time and you are kind of that last leg, you know? And as you said, it's either you shine and you're the star. It's very rare to get that beautiful circle between the food and the pastry, and that was the most fun. And I really just left Aquavit because I had family stuff that I had to tend to. So it may have been very different had I stayed, you know. But I cherish that time.
And if you hadn't left, then you wouldn't have come. I
right.
mean, not, everything not continuously. And then
yeah.
we all wouldn't be here together. And that would make me sad. So, okay, a final question. Is there a woman in the industry who you admire, who's a role model, who you'd like to pay it forward and talk about on the show?
Mais oui. Dominique Crenn. We're doing the dinner with her tomorrow night. Yeah. I'm inspired by her humanitarian ways and her food and the way she talks and supports her team. She seems like a really good human and great energy. And I think it's important to just remember it's not just about the food. It's about the people that supply the food, that actually do their time to be in between preparing and serving and enjoy it as well on the other end, you know. And she's a big role model.
Great.
Yeah, I was going to say the same.
Oh, boy, because you are the same person.
But, I mean, she's always been there, and I love everything she stands for and everything she does, and it's just, it's more about cooking, but she's also there as almost my goal in life. She's the one I feel like I need to catch up to. Like, she's the person that I would love to be or become. So it's always that little, like...
What is the difference between where she is and where you are?
I feel like the way she gets her voice heard and out, like, she's put down so much that I haven't really got the chance to get to yet. So she's finally at that point in her career and her life where she has a powerful enough voice to make changes and people will listen to her. And I think when it comes to cooking nowadays, it's not just about the food, it's also about making a change when it comes to the climate control, the farmers, the gender equality, and everything like that is very important. And for me, it you have to get to a certain level to be able to make that happen. And I think she is one of those people that when she says something, people follow and they listen. And I find that very inspirational to be able to be that person.
So. I would just say to that there's this a woman who I had on my podcast who said, I am just one voice, but I am one. Mm-hmm. And the lesson there is you have a tremendous voice and each one of us can be heard. You just have to say what you want to say and share it, and it will be heard, because if you, and I'm not saying you don't, but you should have confidence in sharing and having your voice heard. You don't need to be Dominique Crenn. Dominique Crenn can, you know, maybe she has a greater radio signal, you know, like it might, but you are so well respected and so heard. Both of you so well respected and loved in your
thank you
in what you do. So with that, I just want to thank you guys both. It was so much fun. I've never done a double interview before. I haven't done a double date, triple date with me. So I just wanted to thank the engineer today, Aaron Parecki, who's the co-founder of Stream PDX. And we're in his amazing Airstream. It's super cool. I'm playing with plastic toys here. I'm really enjoying that.
I have a zebra that I quite like.
You like the zebra? I have a bat. I'm holding onto a bat, and it's white with a little black face. It's really cute. And also, I want to thank Travel Portland and the Julia Child Foundation for making our coverage of Feast possible, and Team Heritage here, which is really great. And thank you guys for coming out and being part of Feast and Heritage.
Thank you.
Thank you.